So we're continuing on with our Frosty the Snowman Advent series here. And as we go, we come to this next character from that 1969 animated special. And his name is Professor Hinkle. And he's the bad guy in this. He's a magician. He's hired to perform at the school's Christmas party. The narrator describes him as the worst magician in the world, as shown when his equipment falls and fails and his tricks just don't work. He puts eggs into his magic hat, which all fall on the floor, and he fails to pull a rabbit out of the hat because Hocus just doesn't obey him. And he has the tendency to repeat adjectives and adverbs when he's excited or stressed. He says things like messy, 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 or busy, busy, busy. And so after his failed attempt at a magic show, the students to whom he was performing put Hinkle's magic hat on Frosty the Snowman. And they had just created Frosty. And that hat brings Frosty to life. And seeing its magical properties, Hinkle takes the hat back along with the rabbit, hoping to become rich through use of the hat. However, Hocus escapes with the hat, takes it back to the children, who once again revive Frosty. And when the children decide to send their friend to the North Pole by train so he can't melt, the professor chases after them, and he's vowing to get that hat back. Well, Hinkle gets lost in the woods, and it's because of something that happened on the train. But eventually he catches up with Frosty and Karen. And Karen's the friend that accompanies him on the trip up north. He ruins Karen's campfire and demands the hat back, only to watch the two run off so fast he can't catch them. However, after Frosty brings Karen into the greenhouse to warm her up, he eventually catches up to them and locks them inside, causing the snowman to melt. Fortunately, Santa Claus arrives and is able to magically revive Frosty. And this is where we come to this scene.
Wait a minute. I want that hat, and I want it now.
Don't you dare touch that.
And just what are you going to do about it?
If you so much as lay a finger on the brim, I'll never bring you another Christmas present as long as you live.
Never?
Never.
No more trick cards or magic balls or...
No more anything.
Oh, that's not fair. I mean, we evil magicians have to make a living too.
Now you go home and write, "I am very sorry for what I did to Frosty 100 zillion times. And then maybe, just maybe, mind you, you'll find something in your stocking tomorrow morning.
A new hat, maybe? Oh, yes, sir. Goodbye, everyone. Sorry to lose and run, but I've got to get busy writing. Busy, busy, busy."
And so he runs off and tries to take care of business. And by the time we see the end credits, he's marching along with Frosty's friends. He's got a brand new hat, and it implies that he's already written up his apologies, and Santa has kept his word, and his rabbit is also seen to decide, which implies that they're reconciled. Last scene, tipping his new hat as he and the others bid farewell to Frosty, who is leaving with Santa, and he's promising to be back on Christmas Day. Well, the bad guy, when we come to Matthew chapter 2, is this king named Herod. And we come to verse 3 of chapter 2, and it says this. It says, "When Herod the king heard this," and what he had heard is that the wise men were saying, the magi were saying, "We've come from the east to worship this king of the Jews." And so when he had heard it, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. You see, Herod was upset because he realized there might be a true king, a son of David, a Jew around whom the nation of Israel could rally. Herod realized he could be dethroned. I mean, he's an Edomite. He's not a Jew. But why was all Jerusalem troubled? Well, because Jerusalem was aware of the political ramifications of what these magi were saying. The birth of a new king introduced the possibility that the people in Israel, and perhaps those in the entire Eastern world, would have someone to support and to whom they would willingly submit. Intimidated by this, Caesar would send down his legions into Jerusalem. The city would be trampled and blood would be shed. And they're recognizing the makings of a revolution. Those closest to Herod foresaw these terrifying consequences. Well, we look at verses 4 through 6, and it says this, "And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. Well, they told him, 'In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler whom will shepherd my people Israel.'" And so these scribes are well aware of what Micah 5:2 says, which said that Jesus Christ would be born in this little city 5 miles outside of Jerusalem. And yet, when you think about it, it amazes you that they didn't even bother to make that short journey to Bethlehem to see what was happening. The wise men spent months, perhaps years, traveling across the desert, spending much money and expending this great amount of energy to seek the Lord. The scribes, who knew the word, wouldn't even get on their feet to see what was happening 5 miles away. And isn't there a warning for you and me there? Sometimes we think knowing the Bible is good enough, but it's doing, not merely knowing the word, that counts. You and I can easily become like these scribes, saying, "Well, we know what's happening. We know what we should be doing, and that's good enough." No, the blessing is in doing, not just in knowing. And the scribes told Herod he would find the Christ in Bethlehem. Bethlehem today is a major disappointment for tourists. I went there, and it's just a letdown, because you go and you're expecting something special, but when they get there, all they see is this Middle Eastern city. They go into the Church of the Nativity, assuming it's going to be awesome, but as you walk in, you see the church itself divided into three sections: Catholic, Eastern, and Russian Orthodox, because these three groups have been fighting for centuries over who should control that site. And there are objects hanging from the ceiling that look like Christmas tree ornaments in a garage sale. And these church groups are fighting, and they got these dusty relics hanging. So it's just disappointing. But you know what? It's okay. You see, when Jesus was born in Bethlehem, he was born in a stable or a cave, which was used as a stable. It wasn't this picturesque setting we often have in our mind. No doubt it was dirty. It had to be that way. Jesus came to a real world as a real man to help real people. And Bethlehem mirrors reality today. Bethlehem is very appropriate for the bread of life to be born. For Bethlehem means house of bread. And this little city, it's an unimpressive little city still. Because Jesus was born there, more songs have been sung about, more poetry written about, more photographs taken of, more trips made to this insignificant little city than any other. Bethlehem is one of the best known places in the world today for one reason, and that's because Jesus was there. And so you and I, Jesus comes into little people like us, people who are dusty in their lives, and they're not, and we're not that impressive, and he makes us great because of who, not because of who we are, but because of whose we are. We are his, and he's the one that can exalt the lowly. Let's not look to be great. Let's allow God to do his work, and he takes care of that. So this Professor Hinkle took these steps to defy Jesus. He didn't even know who it was, and he's telling the wise men something. We come to verse 7 and 8. He said, "Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, 'Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him.'" He's saying, yeah, you go ahead, find him, and when you've located him, come and tell me, okay, so you think about that. He's saying, "Go, come and tell me that I may go and worship him as well." And Herod said that not because he sincerely desired to worship the Lord, but because he was determined to exalt his own position, to establish his own authority, and to eliminate the Babe of Bethlehem. I am so glad he didn't get away with that.